someone says. He stands frozen in place and looks like he's about to cry. Gutierrez has warned me that the characters frighten some children, and when that happens, not to make any sudden gestures. I hear her voice now. Give Goofy a high five, she says. I slowly hold up my cloth paw, and the boy reaches out and touches it. Then he quickly pulls back. He circles me warily, then comes closer and holds up his palm. I give him the high five. His face lights up with a huge smile, and people around us start to applaud. Just as my ability to see disappears, I hear Gutierrez say, Goofy is going to have to go. Say goodbye to Goofy. I hear a chorus of young voices calling out to me as Gutierrez steers us to the exit, which is mercifully close by. I feel like I've only been on stage for a few minutes, but in fact I've completed a standard 30-minute shift. It's a relief to get the heavy head off and recover my vision. Still, I can see why people like Tammy Gutierrez would keep at it for 14 years. Once you've seen those children's faces, nothing else seems quite the same. Part 1. The Wonderful World of Disney. 1. On Monday morning, September 24th, 1984, Michael Eisner woke up feeling a little nervous. It was his first day as chairman and chief executive of the Walt Disney Company. Tall, with dark curly hair at age 42, Eisner still had something of the boyish look of the prep school student he once was. Anxious to make a good first impression, he dressed carefully in a suit and tie and got in his car for the trip to Disney. He planned to drive from his home in Bel Air to Interstate 405 North, then onto the Ventura Freeway. The Disney studio was so far out of the Hollywood mainstream that Eisner had only a vague idea where it was, somewhere in Burbank. Soon he realized he was deep into the San Fernando Valley. He called his lawyer, Irwin Russell, from the car to get directions. When Eisner pulled into the Disney lot, he saw a collection of unassuming, low-rise buildings surrounded by neatly clipped hedges and lawns in a modest 4-acre campus. It was nothing like the imposing, gated entry to Paramount, where Eisner had been president for the past 7 years. Several bushes had been clipped into topiary shapes of Disney animated characters. The animation building that had housed Walt Disney's office was at the intersection of Mickey Avenue and Dopey Drive. Around the corner stood the fading Western set for Zorro, a Disney-produced television show that hadn't been on the air for 23 years. Judging from the nearly empty parking area, he was one of the first to arrive. As he pulled in, Eisner realized he had no idea where to go. Everything had happened so suddenly. Just that Saturday, the board had voted to appoint him chairman and chief executive, along with Frank Wells, a lawyer and former head of Warner Brothers, as president and chief operating officer. A boardroom coup led by Roy Disney had ousted Walt's son-in-law, Ron Miller. The weekend had been filled with meetings with investment bankers and lawyers talking about takeover threats and bandying around financial terms that were unfamiliar to Eisner, such as book value and return on equity. Eisner introduced himself to a guard who summoned Disney's head of public relations, Irwin Oaken. Oaken led him to Walt's old office on the third floor of the animation building. Lining the corridors were original cells, hand